So picture this scenario. It's a story we hear constantly in the world of venture capital and private equity. You have built what you think is just a rock-solid strategy.
Right.
You've assembled a team that looks, incredible on paper. Maybe you've got guys from Goldman, operators from Google.
You've got the track record.
Yeah, you have the track record. You feel like you're holding a royal flush.
You feel invincible. I mean, you've done the work, you've got the deck, you are ready to go.
Exactly. So you walk into a meeting with an institutional investor, a pension fund, an endowment, or maybe a massive family office.
Yeah.
And you pitch your heart out. You show the hockey stick charts, you leave the room, high-fiving your partners, and then absolute silence.
Of course.
Or maybe, 2 weeks later, you get a really polite email saying, "Not a fit at this time."
It is genuinely the most frustrating feeling in the world for a fund manager. It's the fundraising ghost. And usually your first instinct is to blame the investor. You tell yourself, well, they just didn't get it, or they're dinosaurs, they're just too risk averse.
But today, we are going to flip that script completely. We're doing a deep dive into a really fascinating stack of documents we have here.
Really eye-opening stuff.
It is. It's all centered around a digital tool called the Investor Readiness Builder, or IRB, along with its intake forms and this overarching institutional investor readiness framework. And the core argument in these sources is that the problem usually isn't your fund strategy itself. It's actually a translation gap.
It's a massive gap. It is the difference between how a manager sells a vision, which is basically marketing, and how an institutional investor calculates risk.
Which is underwriting.
Exactly, underwriting. Those are two completely different languages.
And to bridge that gap, our mission today is to unpack this specific tool. It's essentially a digital stress test.
It's an interrogator.
Yeah, a digital interrogator that forces managers to answer the absolute hardest questions, the ones they really don't want to answer, before they ever step foot into a boardroom.
We have the actual intake forms from the tool right here, the specific grueling questions it asks, and the framework that explains the why behind them.
I've been reading through these questions, and honestly, some of them made me sweat a little bit.
They should. Honestly, if they don't make you sweat, you probably aren't taking the process seriously enough.
It feels like a masterclass in the psychology of institutional money.
It really does.
We're going to unpack why, according to the source, understatement is actually more credible than emphasis, and why knowing exactly how your deal breaks is the best way to sell it.
That's the key takeaway right there. It's about moving from look how great we are to here is exactly how the machine works, and here's exactly how it could fail.
So let's start with that big philosophical divide. The source material draws a really hard line between marketing and underwriting.
A very hard line.
I think most people assume pitching for money is marketing. You're selling a financial product, right? Why is that mindset wrong?
Well, it's not wrong, but it's incomplete. And it's incredibly dangerous if you stop there. The Institutional Investor Readiness Framework puts it perfectly.
What does it say?
It says that investors, limited partners, LPs, they don't buy dreams. They buy clarity, credibility, and evidence.
Okay.
When you are pitching, you're trying to generate excitement. You use the buzzwords, you talk about massive total addressable markets, you talk about changing the world.
You're like the architect showing this beautiful rendering of a bridge with the sunset behind it.
Precisely. But when an LP is underwriting you, they are doing the exact opposite. They are the structural engineer.
They don't care about the sunset.
They do not care how pretty the bridge is if it collapses in high winds. They are actively trying to kill the idea, looking for the cracks in the cement.
So if I walk in there acting like a hype man, strictly focusing on the beauty of the bridge, I'm actually raising red flags.
You're speaking the wrong language entirely. You're speaking vision, and they're listening for risk.
Wow.
And the framework highlights this critical reality called the first review.
Right, I saw that.
It states that LPs need to understand what you do and what you do not do in 1 or 2 minutes.
1 or 2 minutes. That seems impossibly short for a complex financial strategy. Some of these funds have thesis papers that are 50 pages long.
It is brutal, but you have to think about their volume. They see hundreds of decks a month. Here is the real insight from the source. If your mandate is overly broad, LPs just disengage.
Like saying, "We invest in great tech companies."
Exactly. They disengage not because the strategy is necessarily bad, but because it is difficult to underwrite.
Because they can't box you in.
Right. They can't box you in. They can't measure you against a benchmark. They can't figure out where you fit in their portfolio allocation.
So this IRB tool, it's designed to force you to speak allocator language right out of the gate.
It forces you to define the box. If you can't define the box, you are not getting the check.
Okay, let's look at how it actually forces you to do that.
Yeah.
I'm looking at intake form 1 and 2 here. This is the strategy and timing section.
Standard stuff at first glance.
Yeah, it starts pretty standard. Fund name, asset class. But then it hits you with this question. Why is now the right moment for this strategy?
It seems like a simple question.
It does. But look at the guidance text the tool provides below that question. It explicitly says it doesn't want generic answers like tech is the future.
Or crypto is booming.
Right. It suggests specific triggers. It lists market shift, regulation, valuation dislocation, or technology inflection.
Let's pause on valuation dislocation for a second.
Yeah, that is a very specific phrase. What are they actually looking for there?
They're looking for a structural anomaly in the market. It's not just saying prices are low. It implies that something is fundamentally broken in your favor.
Like what?
Maybe new banking regulations have forced institutions to sell off certain assets cheaply. Or maybe a specific sector is just completely unloved by the public markets right now.
So it demands a reason for existence that is tied directly to the clock.
Exactly. Why this specific vintage? Why is 2026 the year to deploy this capital and not 2025 or 2028?
So if you can't answer that timing question, you're just a tourist.
You're just hoping for beta. You're just hoping the broader market goes up. And institutional investors can get beta for free by buying an S&P 500 index fund.
They pay the high fees for alpha, for skill.
Exactly.
That perfectly leads us to the next question on Form 2, which I found fascinating. It asks, how does this strategy translate into returns? And the source explicitly warns the user here to focus on mechanisms, not proof.
That distinction right there separates the amateurs from the pros.
Break that down.
Proof is saying we targeted a 20% IRR in our last fund and we hit it.
It's historical.
It's looking in the rearview mirror. A mechanism is explaining the actual gearbox. How does the engine of your fund work today?
Give me a concrete example. What does a mechanism look like in the wild?
The source lists things like pricing power, operational leverage, or a sourcing advantage. So instead of just saying we pick winners, a mechanism sounds like this. We buy family-owned plumbing businesses. We centralize their back-office software, which cuts overhead by 15%, and we use that extra margin to acquire their competitors.
That's a formula. That's highly repeatable.
Yes. You are describing the physics of your value creation. If you just say, we have a great network in Silicon Valley, that's not a mechanism.
That's a vibe.
That's a vibe. And LPs do not underwrite vibes.
This gets even more intense when we move to intake form 3. This is the section entirely dedicated to return mechanics.
It's rigorous.
Looking at these screenshots, this looks less like a standard investor questionnaire and more like a final exam for a finance master's program.
It really is. Most pitch decks just slap a 25% target IRR on a slide and move on to the team bios.
Maybe they show a chart going up and to the right.
Right. But this tool flat out refuses to accept that.
It's asking for entry and exit assumptions. It wants the target company revenue at entry versus the target company revenue at exit.
It asks for EBITDA margins at entry and exit, too.
It even asks for net debt to EBITDA levels.
It is incredibly granular. It forces the manager to literally show their math. Think about it. If you say you're going to triple my money, where exactly is that multiple coming from?
Well, I'd assume it comes from the company growing its sales.
That's one way. That's revenue growth. But maybe it comes from margin expansion, making the company more efficient and profitable.
Or maybe it comes from multiple expansion.
Yes.
Multiple expansion. Just break that down quickly for us.
That's essentially buying a company for 5 times its earnings and selling it later for 10 times its earnings.
Just buying low and selling high in terms of valuation.
Right. But if this form forces you to break down your math, and it turns out 80% of your projected return comes from multiple expansion.
Which is basically just hoping someone pays a higher premium later than you did today.
Exactly. An institutional investor is going to absolutely shred you for that.
Because that's not actual skill.
That's gambling. That relies on the macro market being hot when you eventually sell. Institutions hate paying 2% management fees for luck.
They want to see that you did the work.
They want to see the sweat equity in the numbers. You grew the revenue, you improved the margins, you paid down the debt. They want to see precise return attribution.
Which brings us to the section of the tool that I found the most terrifying. The section called Return Fragility and Dependency Conditions.
Oh, this is my favorite part of the entire framework.
You're a masochist.
Maybe. But listen to the actual prompt the tool gives the manager. What assumptions must hold for these return drivers to work?
It's asking you to list the exact conditions that must remain true. It's basically saying, show me how your house of cards falls down.
Correct. And then right below that is the downside case section. Read the instruction text there. It's so specific.
It says, identify the single assumption that would most materially reduce returns if it underperforms.
The single assumption.
And it gives examples. Slower revenue growth, delayed margin expansion. Why does that distinction matter so much? Why single?
Because unsophisticated managers list generic macro risks. They say things like, well, there could be a recession, or new competitors could arise, geopolitics.
It's a total cop-out answer.
Exactly. It's noise. Everyone on earth knows there could be a recession. A sophisticated manager knows exactly where their specific lever is.
Right.
They know that if customer churn goes up by just 2%, their entire model breaks. Or if they can't hire 50 sales reps in year one, they miss their exit target entirely.
But wait, if I admit that, if I look an investor in the eye and say, hey, if churn hits 5%, we're going to lose your money, doesn't that just scare them away?
In marketing, yes. In underwriting, it does the exact opposite.
Really?
It tells the investor you truly understand the mechanics of your own business model. It tells them you are going to watch that specific metric like a hawk.
Because you know it's the glass jaw.
Right. If you claim there is no single point of failure, they don't think your fund is safe. They think you haven't looked hard enough at your own math.
So admitting exactly where you are weak actually makes you look incredibly strong to an allocator.
Absolutely. It's the difference between true confidence and blind arrogance.
That segues perfectly into intake form 4, which is all about the psychology of risk. The readiness framework source has this phrase that I literally underlined twice. It says, calm risk acknowledgement increases institutional confidence.
It is so counterintuitive to human nature, isn't it?
It really is. The natural sales instinct is to hide the risk, to put lipstick on the pig.
Totally. You want to walk in and say, this is a sure thing, asymmetric upside, minimal downside.
But the framework calls that out as a massive rookie mistake. It says managers often try to minimize or dismiss obvious risks, or they just treat risk as a compliance exercise.
Like, oh, we have to list these 20 risks on page 40 for the lawyers, but don't actually worry about them. They won't happen. Institutional investors manage risk for a living. That is their entire job description. If you sit there and say there are no risks, they assume you are either lying to them or you are completely naive. And neither of those profiles is investable.
The tool asks the manager for the top 3 risks an LP should understand.
Yeah.
And then this is the part I thought was brilliant. It asks for risks intentionally accepted.
Now that is a power move. Risks intentionally accepted.
How so?
It fundamentally changes the dynamic. It shifts the conversation from, oops, we have a vulnerability, to we clearly see this volatility and we're strategically choosing to embrace it because the mathematical payout is worth it.
Can you give me a real-world example of a risk intentionally accepted?
Sure. Let's say your fund invests in distressed debt in emerging markets. The obvious risk is currency fluctuation or severe political instability.
Can't hide that.
You don't even try. You walk in and say, we explicitly accept the political risk in Brazil right now because these assets are trading at 30 cents on the dollar, and we have mathematically structured our exit timeline to account for massive currency swings.
You frame yourself as a cold calculator, not a gambler at a roulette table.
Precisely. You're telling the allocator, I bought the ticket and I know exactly what the ride looks like.
Okay, moving on to intake form 5, differentiation. This is the part of every pitch where everyone says, we are unique. We are proprietary. We have a special sauce.
And the framework source issues a very blunt warning here. It says, don't claim to be unique without evidence.
It also makes a really sharp distinction between features and advantages. Let me understand that because I feel like those words get thrown around interchangeably in pitch meetings.
They do, but they are very different. A feature is just something you have.
Like what?
Like saying, we have a proprietary database of 10,000 private companies. That's a feature. To an LP, who cares?
So what's the advantage then?
The advantage is what you actually win because of that feature.
Ah.
So the advantage is, because of this database, we see deals 2 full weeks before any other fund, which allows us to buy in at a 15% discount to the broader market.
I see. So the feature is the tool in the shed, but the advantage is the actual result on the scoreboard.
Right. And notice the specific prompt on the form. Why does this advantage matter for LPs?
It forces the connection.
Because it's not enough to just be different. Being different is incredibly easy. I can start a venture fund tomorrow that only invests in startups run by founders named Steve.
That is definitely unique.
Highly unique.
But probably not very profitable.
Exactly. That difference has to directly translate into lower structural risk or higher baseline returns. The source says understatement is often more credible than emphasis. If you have to scream at the top of your lungs that you're unique, you probably aren't.
Let's pivot and talk about the people. Forms 5 and 6, cover team and governance.
This is where the whole rock star myth comes to die.
The rock star myth.
The idea of the solo genius. I'm a brilliant investor, just give me the money and get out of my way.
I'm the next Warren Buffett, trust me.
The framework explicitly states LPs underwrite processes, not resumes.
Meaning, they want to know what happens if the supposed genius gets hit by a bus.
Or honestly, just has a bad day. Or gets a divorce and loses focus for a year. The tool asks for key governance features.
Like investment committees.
Investment committees, risk controls, oversight mechanisms. It's asking about the system of decision-making, not the individual.
It's the difference between an artist and a factory. The artist makes great things, but the factory is actually scalable.
And investable. Pension funds absolutely love factories. They love predictable, repeatable outputs. They get very nervous around temperamental artists.
Now, there is one last section on the intake forms that I found really surprising. Form 6 asks for LP profiles that should not invest in your fund.
The anti-portfolio.
Yeah. Why would you ever tell a software tool or an actual investor who you do not want money from? Fundraising is hard enough as it is. Isn't all money green?
It is a massive signal of maturity. The framework explains that real institutional maturity is knowing exactly who you aren't a fit for.
But practically speaking, who would you actually turn down?
Well, maybe your strategy is highly illiquid. Say you're buying timberland or forests. It takes 15 years to get the money back. You are a terrible fit for a family office that needs cash flow every quarter to pay for the maintenance on a yacht.
Or maybe you're doing defense tech, and certain university endowments have strict ESG mandates against weapons.
Exactly. If you take money from the wrong LP just to close the fund, you are just buying future friction.
You're inviting a boss who hates your work style into your house.
Yes. Admitting that upfront prevents a really bad marriage down the road.
It sounds like that confidence piece again.
Yeah.
I know exactly who I am, and I know exactly who I'm not.
And LPs respect that immensely. It saves their time, too.
So you go through this entire gauntlet. The source says it takes about 30 to 45 minutes to complete the IRB. Mm-hmm. Although looking at the depth of these questions, I feel like it might take a week of deep soul searching.
Well, it's 30 to 45 minutes of actual typing. But it takes years of hard experience to actually know the answers. If you don't know the answers going in, it might take you 3 months to figure them out.
Fair point. So you finally hit submit. What comes out the other side? The source talks about an investor readiness pack.
This is where the real value proposition clicks into place. You don't get a pretty glossy marketing brochure out of this. You get raw underwriting materials.
The list of deliverables includes a red flag radar,
which identifies what they call IC tripwires.
IC being investment committee.
Right. It basically says, here are the specific mathematical or logical flaws that will get you killed in an investment committee meeting. It warns you before you ever walk in the room.
And there's also a priority fix list.
Ranked underwriting gaps. It's like getting a diagnostic report from a mechanic.
Yeah.
You need to fix the transmission before you try to sell this car to anyone.
But the most interesting deliverable to me was the draft narrative. The source describes it as an IC-style memo.
That is so critical. Do you know what an IC memo actually is in this context?
I assume it's the internal document the investors write themselves.
Yes. When you pitch a junior analyst at a massive pension fund, if they actually like you, they have to write a highly detailed memo to their boss recommending your fund.
So they have to do a ton of homework on you.
A ton of homework. This tool effectively writes that initial memo for them using your stress-tested data. It frames your entire argument in their specific template.
You're making it incredibly easy for them to sell you to their boss.
You are doing their job for them. Mm-hmm. And in the world of institutional finance, if you reduce the analytical friction for the analyst, your odds of getting to the next stage go up exponentially.
And we should definitely mention the context here from the source. It notes the pricing 552 euros for early adopters, usually 690 euros.
Which, if you compare that to a traditional placement agent who might charge a $20,000 retainer plus a massive success fee, is essentially free.
But the source is very clear on this point. It says this is not marketing. This is not placement.
Right. It doesn't introduce you to a single investor. It prepares you for them. It's the gym before the championship game.
I love that analogy.
You don't win the game in the gym, but you sure as hell can lose the game if you didn't bother to go.
So let's bring this all together. We started with the idea of the translation gap, the manager speaking vision, and the investor listening for risk.
And the investor readiness builder acts as a mirror to fix that.
But not a flattering funhouse mirror.
No, a harsh, bright light mirror in a dressing room that shows you exactly what the institutional investor is going to see.
It completely strips away the marketing buzzwords. It forces you to do the hard math on your entry and exit assumptions. It forces you to admit exactly how your own machine breaks.
And by doing all of that, it solves the problem of narrative misalignment. When you finally do walk into that real pitch meeting, you aren't just telling a nice story anymore.
You are presenting a stress-tested, mathematically rigorous investment case.
You are speaking their native language, and that makes it so much easier for them to say yes because you have already done the hard work of underwriting yourself.
It's truly a fascinating look at the hidden machinery of how big money actually moves. It's not about charm. It's about structure.
Discipline, focus, and repeatability. That is the holy trinity for LPs.
So here is our final challenge to you, the listener. Whether you are out there raising a billion-dollar private equity fund or you're just pitching a new project to your CFO next week,
think about your current plan.
If you sat down right now with absolutely no preparation, could you answer that one specific question from Intake Form 3?
Can you name the single assumption that, if it fails, breaks your entire business model?
If you can't answer that, you might be ready to pitch. But you definitely aren't ready to be underwritten.
That's something to think about.
Thanks for diving deep with us today. We'll see you on the next one.